Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
This period may be a watershed for many of us, individually or socially, spiritually. I'm recording this on April 9th, 2020. As we're entering into a global pandemic that's growing at an explosive rate in America and in Texas. A lot of us are staying home. There's a lot of fear about infection. There's also a lot of economic insecurity among many people. And it's been very disappointing for us, a lot of us, to see how badly our institutions are failing us during this period. The pandemic does have its bright sides, though. It gives many of us under stay-at-home restrictions an opportunity for practice, and a lot of people are working on their meditation practice and reading Dharma, people that I've heard from. It also gives us a sense of being in this together, a sense of solidarity. For many people, it gives us a chance to slow down, connect with family, and also to find inspiration for those who are on the front line of the epidemic. One of the things I would like to suggest for Buddhists out there with extra time on their hands and during this special watershed period, that they contemplate a number of topics. For instance, what is it to live a meaningful, fulfilling life? What do I want my life to look like? Our lives may not be the same when this is all over as it was before. And even what kind of society would we like to see that can support the life we would like to live and in which we would like to develop spiritually? In general, we can ask the question, what is most meaningful in life? Lately, I've been reading a lot about the psychology of motivation. As I've become familiar with some of this research, it struck me how closely the conclusions that psychologists have been reaching are to a Buddhist understanding of such matters. It even has the radical flavor of Buddhism that questions our most cherished assumptions. But in particular, it gives us an indictment against modern society and who we've become and how we live in modern society. It's also very helpful to see empirical verification for some of what is quite standard thinking in Dharma. Psychologists used to think motivation comes from discomfort or dissatisfaction, roughly what we call suffering in Buddhism. Namely, we don't like how things are, or we imagine something better, so we change it, and that's what motivates us. We do things because we have some goal in mind. This is now called extrinsic motivation, in which a task is performed in order to achieve some goal outside of the task itself, for instance, receiving a reward or avoiding a punishment, as when we work for pay and we work even harder in order not to get fired. But then psychologists began to recognize that there are a lot of motivations that are not extrinsic. Children play with nothing further in mind than to play. Adults knit or fly fish just to knit or fly fish. We do these things with no particular goal in mind beyond the activities themselves. In intrinsic motivation, a task is satisfying and worth pursuing in itself. The concept of intrinsic motivation doesn't exist in Buddhism, but once it's identified, we can see that Buddhist practice across the board pushes us towards intrinsic motivation. And Buddhist psychology predicts many of the same virtues of intrinsic motivation that has been demonstrated experimentally in modern psychological research. Briefly, extrinsic motivation entails a level of craving and attachment or seeking of personal advantage. Although difficult to remove altogether, these bases of extrinsic motivation are regarded as problematic in Buddhism. I've recently wrote an essay called The Wonder of Intrinsic Motivation that's posted on my website, bhikkhucintita.wordpress.com, which gives a lot more detail than what I'm going to talk about today and probably next week. A couple of very good books from the psychological perspective, the perspective of modern psychology, are Edward Deci's Why We Do What We Do. Deci is spelled D-E-C-I. And then Tim Kasser's The High Price of Materialism. Kasser is K-A-S-S-E-R. Psychological research indicates there's some truly astonishing differences between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation in terms not only of the greater degree of satisfaction, meaning, and well-being enjoyed by the intrinsically engaged, but also in terms of the greater proficiency and creativity they bring to their engagement. Let's look at some examples, especially experimental results. People in general love the intellectual challenge of solving puzzles. People do crossword puzzles, jigsaw puzzles, work out, play with Rubik's cubes, with no immediate purpose in mind other than that it seems interesting. Even other primates are discovered to share such motivations. For instance, monkeys giving an apparatus with hasps, hooks, and hinges will spend many hours figuring out how to open and close the parts. Focused and determined, they require no tangible reward outside of obvious enjoyment in the activity itself. Cats may have some of this quality as well, for they are notoriously curious. This is intrinsic motivation. Let's run some experiments. The experiments from psychology usually involve setting up two groups of human subjects, A and B, who are invited to perform some task. How they spontaneously engage in the task indicates the degree of intrinsic motivation. The researcher can't really control that. But generally, one group will be given an extrinsic motivation as a reward or a punishment, and the other group not. And then various consequences can be quantified. For instance, suppose groups A and B are both already intrinsically motivated. If we offer A an additional extrinsic motivation, does that double up A's motivation? It turns out that it doesn't. In one experiment, each member of groups A and B is presented with a puzzle, intrinsically interesting in itself. A is offered a monetary reward for good performance, while B, the control group, is unrewarded. Once they've been paid, members of A will no longer have interest in the puzzle during a free choice period, while members of B will continue to play with the puzzles. In another experiment, each member of A was instead given a punishment for poor performance rather than a reward for good performance. The results were much the same. In another experiment, the extrinsic motivation given to A was that of beating a competitor. The results were much the same. It turns out that an extrinsic motivation will generally replace an intrinsic motivation. Once an extrinsic motivation is given to the subject, the prior intrinsic motivation will disappear. Deci recounts a Jewish story about a Jewish tailor who moves into town. The town's bigots encourage some ruffians to jeer at the tailor each day, which they were apparently delighted to do. But the tailor was very clever. He offered each ruffian a reward each time he came to jeer, say 50 cents. Each day they came, jeered, and received their payment. Then the tailor reduced the payment to 10 cents, and then finally to 1 cent. 1 cent was not enough payment for their valuable time and skill, so they stopped coming. The extrinsic motivation displaced the intrinsic motivation. The extrinsic motivation was then removed, and the ruffians were left with no motivation at all. Children are like monkeys. They're fonts of intrinsic motivation. Naturally curious, they are learning machines in their early years. Shouldn't this be good news for an educator who only needs to direct and deepen this reservoir of motivation? Unfortunately, education, at least in the United States, is traditionally involves using a variety of extrinsic motivations in teachings. In teaching, we have tests, gold stars, grades, report cards. We even doubled down with extrinsic motivation with the introduction in 2002 of mandated testing nationwide. In spite of expectations, schools tend to be dreary and uninspiring places for future scientists, artists, and explorers. If a typical experimental group A of young, eager minds was told that they would be given a test to evaluate their comprehension of a passage they were asked to read. Group B, the control, was asked to read the passage, but didn't know that they would also be given a test. But then both A and B received the same test. A, in other words, was extrinsically motivated to pass the test. B had only intrinsic motivation to rely on. It was found that although extrinsically motivated A had better rote recollection of the content of the passage, intrinsically motivated B was found to have better conceptual understanding. Moreover, 1 week later, a second unannounced test was administered to both groups. B had superior recollection of the passage. In another experiment, more advanced students were asked to learn some complex material on neural psychology. Members of Group A were told that they would be tested and graded on the material. Members of Group B that they would be asked to teach the material to others. Group B was found to have acquired greater conceptual understanding. Actually, it would seem that A and B were both offered extrinsic motivations, A to pass a test and B to teach. But B seems to have an intrinsically motivated behavior. What's going on here? From the Buddhist perspective, this is clear. B was asked to prepare to benefit others rather than to benefit themselves. Similarly, when two groups, A and B, are asked to produce artwork, and A is asked to produce under extrinsically motivated conditions, and B under intrinsically motivated conditions, A's work was found under objective criteria for evaluating such things to be of poorer quality than Group B's artwork produced under intrinsic conditions. Consistently, intrinsic motivation is discovered to lead to improved problem solving, to better conceptual understanding, to greater activity, and to a richer, more satisfying learning experience. What happens at higher levels of intellectual or artistic accomplishment? What kind of motivation produces an Einstein, for instance? Einstein developed the special theory of relativity when he was a clerk at a patent office in Switzerland. Did he do this to make a lot of money, or for fame, or to advance his career? Or was it more like play, curiosity, and a passion for solving puzzles? It did advance his career, and brought him fame. But this is what intrinsic motivation often does as a side effect, is because it tends to bring out the highest levels of accomplishment. We need to keep this in mind in our Buddhist practice as well. In Buddhism, we don't produce geniuses, we produce awakened people. To what extent can our practice be intrinsically motivated? This is a kind of paradox that advanced practitioners are very aware of. Our practice does have direction, and we tend to set goals or at least milestones, but striving toward them is problematic. Can we practice without expectation just because it is the same thing to do? This would be intrinsic motivation. A famous Zen koan is as follows. Jiaozhou asked Nanjuan, "What is the way?" Nanjuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." Jiaozhou asked, "Then may I direct myself toward it or not?" Nanjuan said, "To turn toward it is to turn away from it." There's a kind of art to reframing our goals toward intrinsic motivation and away from extrinsic motivation. Consider going on a diet. Most typically, you diet with the extrinsic goal of a sexier, slimmer, 20 pounds lighter me on the beach next summer. The goal is achieved by keeping eyes on the prize while undergoing starvation and exercise, a process that provides little satisfaction in itself. As any dieter knows, there's a lot of emoting and suffering in the process, constantly weighing yourself, continually prodded by shame and longing for the end result. Moreover, when the goal is reached, satisfaction is short-lived. For now, you have to, by the same means, maintain your sexier, slimmer, and healthier me for the following summer. Alternatively, you might instead frame the same result in terms of a simple health standard to bear in mind, that of living an optimal lifestyle with daily nutritional intake and bodily activity optimized for your body type. The standard never lies in the future, but is achieved each day, and thereby it's not an extrinsic motivation. In case of lapse, you acknowledge it and determine to do better the next day. There's effort involved, but no striving or emoting. In fact, as you inhabit this practice, you're very likely to become an expert in nutrition and exercise and the other real needs of the human body, to which your attention is directed in lieu of standing on the scale each day and emoting accordingly. You find satisfaction in the process itself and a kind of joy. You become devoted to this aspect of health. As an extra benefit, you attain and maintain with ease the goal you gave up in the first place. Desi quotes someone as saying, "If you dare to be fat, then you can be thin." In Buddhism, if you dare to be a spiritual basket case, you can be awakened. There's a deep chasm through the middle of our culture with profound implications for human psychological and spiritual well-being, for the very direction of people's lives, for the structure of our economy, and for the way children are brought up and educated. Somehow, the dominant idea is that it's a good idea to be goal-oriented. Consumerism is the master motivator in our culture, encouraged by modern marketing and manifesting as desire for wealth, fame, sex appeal, power, and so on. Materialism or consumerism is such a dominant motivator that it's regarded by many critics as having taken on the role of a religion in defining the ultimate values and strategies of many of our lives. It belongs by definition solely within extrinsic orientation. It has also been discovered to have many adverse consequences for the well-being of people in our society. Studies show that aspiring to wealth without necessarily getting it is associated with lower levels of vitality and higher levels of depression or anxiety. People oriented toward possessions, popularity, and attractiveness tend to suffer more frequent headaches, backaches, sore muscles, and sore throats. Materially oriented people have higher levels of alcohol and drug consumption and fewer positive emotions. Materialistic teens tend to be more socially isolated and suspicious of others' intentions. Here's an interesting one. Death is a theme in 20.5% of the dreams of materialistic people, and in only 3% for non-materialistic people. Materialists have lower quality relations and tend to be more aggressive. Beyond satisfying basic level of needs, the Buddha also talked about food and shelter, and we can also include lifting yourself out of poverty as basic needs. The Buddha talked about these as prerequisites for spiritual development. Beyond satisfying these basic needs, actually reaching goals of attaining wealth, possessions, or status yields empirically no long-term increase in well-being whatever. Rather, such success tends to feel empty and unsatisfying. Studies show that lottery winners end up, on average, being no more happy and tend to find less pleasure in everyday events after they hit it big. Materialism is associated with chronically low self-esteem. Goal-oriented people who actually manage to achieve their goals are often exalted as celebrities in our society. In fact, they are mentally and spiritually worse off than most of the rest of us. We're such fools to take them as role models. Buddhism predicts something like this. No wonder we're so mentally unhealthy as a culture. I haven't really showed so far how Buddhism consistently leans us toward intrinsic motivation and accounts for the main thrust of the experimental evidence for the remarkable qualities associated with intrinsic motivation. Psychology has developed a theory called self-determination theory to account for this evidence, having to do roughly with who is in control, me or someone outside who is calling the shots. The Buddhist account is a matter of ethics. I'm going to talk about this hopefully in next week's podcast, but let me give a taste of what motivational structure looks like in Buddhism. We're used to seeing mindfulness defined as something like bare, non-judgmental, present moment awareness. This is actually a 20th century description that conflates elements of mindfulness with elements of concentration or samadhi. The original word for mindfulness, sati, actually means memory, which suggests that mindfulness is actually in dialogue with the past, not just the present. We can understand mindfulness provisionally as remembering what our current task is and how to do it well. Part of the skill of doing this is to hold distractions at least temporarily at bay. We easily forget what is really relevant to the present task when we are distracted. These distractions include any future extrinsic goals we have in performing the task. The why tends to drop out of mind in favor of the how when we are engaged mindfully. For instance, if our action is washing dishes, mindfulness brings to mind an array of knowledge and experience about which implement to scrub with, about how much detergent to use, about how much force to exert, about how hot the water should be, and so on. Without mindfulness, our future concerns might induce us to hurry through the job so that we don't get fired or to look forward to the praise we'll receive when people behold sparkling clean dishes. Thich Nhat Hanh tells us that it's best if we wash the dishes in order to wash the dishes, rather than order to have clean dishes. In washing, in order to wash, mindfulness rather than any extrinsic motivation becomes the guide. Of course, it's advisable to turn off the radio and wash silently to wash away all distractions. Similarly, a sales employee named Bob in a clothing store can be mindful of the inventory, color schemes, current fashions, etc., but also be intent on getting a commission for a successful sale and worried about doing something that'll get him fired. When Bob is worried about being fired or anxious for a bonus, he has, in his striving, been known to cut corners and lie a little to the customer, sometimes to overcharge. But with mindfulness training, Bob is more likely to be diligent, upright, and honest in his approach to his job. He might still get fired, but is actually more likely, it's more likely for his boss admiring his greater competence and the acclaim of customers to give him a raise. Let me suggest a couple of practice tasks, a little bit of homework for the next week while you're spending time, presumably secluded from workaday life. First, ask yourself, what are my passions? The word passion is interesting in English. It can mean something like lust, which is often considered to be a negative quality in Buddhism. But it also refers to intrinsic motivation. What kinds of things do I find really satisfying in themselves? Whether it's music, whether it's Buddhist practice, whether it's spending time with friends, whether it's doing things for others. It's very interesting to look at. The second assignment is spend some time during the week practicing mindfulness. You can try to practice mindfulness throughout the day, or you can practice it during certain intervals. Of course, we practice mindfulness on the cushion, but take it beyond the cushion. Mindfully wash dishes, for instance. As you do so, notice the motivational structure. Notice what mindfulness brings to it. If you're not mindful, you will have a tendency to look forward to things, to look forward to finishing, to look forward to the goal of what you would otherwise be mindfully engaged in. But when you're mindful, you'll notice that that extrinsic goal tends to disappear, and instead it's replaced by more intrinsic satisfaction in the task itself, and also a tendency to do the task proficiently. So this is a little something you may look at during the next week.